this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
This war has been going on since at least 2002 under sanctions, economic warfare, lawfare, subversion, this kidnapping and the murder of our comrades and fellow human beings in Venezuela is just the latest instance.
Protests have erupted in the U.S. after the Trump administration bombed Venezuela and kidnapped President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores.
Socialists have always argued that U.S. military operations in Africa routinely justify as counterterrorism. In practice, these functions are practically imperialist domination.
The Trump administration bombed Nigeria on Christmas Day, claiming to be protecting Christians. But Nigerian socialist Sadare Oladimeji says it has only encouraged sectarian divisions.
These programs sit at the intersection of pandemic preparedness and biosecurity risk. The same research that can produce vaccines or antiviral measures can also inadvertently or deliberately create more virulent or transmissible versions of existing pathogens.
Dr. Peter McCullough reports on U.S. biolabs and their participation in potential biowarfare programs using gain-of-function, lab-based enhancement methods. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. An emergency rally was held in San Francisco to oppose the invasion of Venezuela. Austin Cole of the Black Alliance for Peace and Frank Lara, Executive Vice President of United Educators of San Francisco, both spoke.
Comrades, we are at war! Who knows that we are at war?
I know!
We know that we have been at war since 1492. We know that we have been at war since the European ships came to the shores of Africa and stole economic warfare, lawfare, subversion, this kidnapping and the murder of our comrades and fellow human beings in Venezuela is just the latest instance.
Shame!
Shame! So I'm going to read a part of that statement, and I want everyone to see, hear, and hear what the speakers are saying today, that we need every single one of you to be out in the streets, to be organizing in your neighborhoods, and to resist. The Black Alliance for Peace strongly condemns the international lawlessness of the neo-fascist U.S. and the violent aggression and blatant attacks against Venezuela. Despite what Trump said, we know that the U.S. is not running Venezuela, that the people run Venezuela, that Nicolas Maduro, that we support him, and Celia Flores, but we know that the Bolivarian Revolution is not a single person. It is the revolution of the people, the working people, the popular movements of Venezuela have taken to the streets, and they are in command of Venezuela, and they will continue to fight for their rights, for all of our Americas, and for this entire world, just as the people of Palestine, the people of Iran, and the people all throughout the world continue to fight for liberation and for sovereignty. Yes. So for us, we understand this is not a singular moment. We understand that the same tactics were used in Haiti when Jean-Bertrand Aristide was kidnapped and flown to the Republic of Congo. We understand that this will continue to go on until you understand the power of you building community here at this time. The insanity that we woke up to today should not be minimized. The insanity that we watched today should not be minimized.
That's right. That's
for the last, and it builds upon another insanity which we've witnessed for years now with the genocide in Palestine. It's important to see the connections because Latin America sees that connection. The president of Colombia, Petro, said, what you are witnessing in Gaza is a message to all countries that decide to stand up for dignity and independence. And that is the character of a dying empire. And it is the darkest moments it can feel alone. It can feel isolating, but also within the dark is when the light shines the brightest. And you are that light. These actions are happening in over 70 cities, and they got mobilized today because good people, honest people, people who love their communities came out like you did today. I've been a teacher here in San Francisco. I've been a union leader. And our union's preparing to go on strike at the end of the month. And we're preparing to go on strike for crumbs. Let's make that clear. We're preparing to go on strike for healthcare, for basic raises, for basic services for our students. So while the Trump administration, and it doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat, it's the wealthy that are currently robbing us of our wealth, of our future, because we can't even dare to demand something just. Yet, they have the power to carry out the insanity we are seeing today. So I tell you, and we've been fighting this, I remember in 2009, when I woke up also to see Manuel Zelaya from Honduras kidnapped in the same manner. The new generation does not believe in this system. For those of us who've been around, let's not justify this for that, not try and claim, well, there's problems with that system. There's problems with that leader. Trump tried to carry out a coup in this country. We live in a city that a billionaire bought an election. Let's not claim that anyone in this country can justify a coup, a kidnapping, a bombing in any other country. So to wrap up, especially if you're joining for the first time, join this movement. Get involved in this movement. Sign up. Get involved in your community. The same way we're running on the Left Unity slate, on the Vote Socialist slate for the upcoming elections, that's another route that we take the message of the people, the message against war, the message to fund our needs to the ballot box, but know that your power is here and that we will continue fighting.
Those were speakers from a rally against the U.S. attack on Venezuela, Austin Cole with the Black Alliance for Peace, and Frank Lara, Executive Vice President of the United Educators of San Francisco.
Nunca es eterna una mentira. La cuerda tensa, tiran y tiran. Los rusos Venezuela miran y miran. No se la van a llevar de arriba. Nunca es eterna una mentira. La cuerda tensa, tiran y tiran. La casa no está en venta, se me retiran.
Se me retiran, se te retiran. El alquitrán hirviendo en el asfalto en que desfilan. Esas familias que son ejemplo, que cuidan a la patria como un templo y se desploman esos intentos. Ya no hay colonia, el perfume huele a gloria y la carroña en su lamento no puede y agradezco cada sacrificio de cada compatriota que no cede ante el desquicio del que quiere tragarse hasta el último resquicio de riqueza que ambiciona lo que está bajo del piso. Qué mal que hizo los cálculos el pato Donald. Qué feo es verlo como desentona en zonas que cree conocer, acostumbrado al monopolio. No entiende que haya gente que no se vende al demonio. Que Venezuela tiene el más preciado patrimonio. Más pelotas que coltán y más ovarios que petróleo. Y ya está harto de tanta pantomima, de ver tantos que vacilan, tantos kilas que se alquilan. Se dilatan las pupilas, se delatan las usinas imperiales que cocinan esos golpes que no atinan. ¿Qué se siente ver al mestizo y al indígena en una posición que no reflejan tus películas? Mirándote de frente sin miedo ni súplicas y sin más dirección que la que surge de su rúbrica. ¿Le duele? No, no le den al que no pide. Sepan que hoy más que nunca Chávez vive. Vive, deja de repetir el discurso de CNN. SNN sino cenas por necesidad de quienes retienen cargamentos con el sustento que viene, con los medicamentos y alimentos que contienen. Yo me retuerzo si hago un esfuerzo por no vomitar al verlos pidiendo refuerzos.
That was Venezuela by Daniel De Vita. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. The Trump administration bombed Nigeria on Christmas Day, claiming to be protecting Christians. But Nigerian socialist Sadari Oladimeji says it has only encouraged sectarian divisions. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the social and economic conditions in Nigeria and the attacks on both Nigeria and Venezuela for their oil resources.
The U.S. government, the Trump administration, launched missiles into Nigeria, saying they wanted to attack Muslims who they accused of killing Christians in Nigeria. And this is connected with bombings, not just in Nigeria, but in Sudan. And joining us today is Sadare Oladimeji. He's with Workers and Youth Solidarity Movement and Revolutionary Socialist Movement. Welcome to our show.
Good morning.
So why don't you let us know what's going on in Nigeria, what the reaction of people in Nigeria is to the bombing of your country by the Trump government?
The bombing is at a critical point in the sense that issues like that are always dividing Nigerians along religion and ethnic line. Don't forget that Nigeria is always Nigeria has a population of Muslims and Christians. And most times, the ruling class are always dividing Nigeria along Christians and Muslim line. Now, it is clear what we have. Nigeria has been bombed on the Christmas Day in Sokoto State. Intention of the U.S. is to, of the people in Washington, describe the operation as a precise counterterrorism mission against ICIC link fighters. Of course, people are being attacked, Muslims are being killed, Christians are being killed in Nigeria. But the most prominent killing is the Christians. And they also, fundamentally, is that human beings are being attacked violently, school children are being attacked, Muslims are being attacked, Christians are being attacked, communities are being ransacked.
And what effect on the political situation in Nigeria to attack these Muslims? And apparently, is there any evidence that these Muslims were engaged in killing Christians?
This has practically affected us. As is going, the continued bombing of is welcomed. Let me say that this is welcomed by some Nigerians who are tired of killings. Who are tired of killings by an attack by the Boko Haram or whatever you call it, bandits, ICIC or whichever name they are called. This attack has always been like this for years. The Nigerian military and the security architecture is completely overwhelmed. There is no serious political way to tackle this. And it's glaring to the ordinary people that the ruling class is not ready to tackle this menace created by politicians.
One of them are groups that were recently attacked and won a court settlement was End Bad Government. Why did the government attack that organization?
The issue at hand is that there are people who support the U.S. to come and rescue communities, villages, towns from banditry, from terrorism. There are people who say it is an attack on Nigerian sovereignty. But we, in the socialists, have always argued that U.S. military operations in Africa routinely justify as counterterrorism. In practice, these functions are practically imperialist domination. The U.S. does not have a base in Nigeria before, but with this now, the U.S. may have a base in Nigeria. The Nigerian armed forces have struggled for years to suppress all these armed groups, not only in the West, Northwest, even in the Northeast, even in the North Central. In North Central, in Benue State, in Plateau, there has been mass killings. Directly with air power, Washington presents itself as an indispensable to Nigerian internal security. But we know that all of this, from our bitter experience from Syria to Libya to Sudan, there is not going to be any problem. So I may not directly be able to give you coherence in the questions because the situations are not also direct. So we must be sure of one thing. Imperialist domination practically don't solve problem. In fact, the UF will have more influence in Nigeria, which may practically affect our own sovereignty. We have argued that the military should be able to confront banditry, terrorism, but they have shown incapacitated and unable to. So the coming of the US is applauded by some people, is rejected and opposed to by some people, but we came out with a clear analysis. It is nothing but imperialist domination.
And the capitalist government, as you have reported earlier, is a corrupt government. Even though Nigeria is a very wealthy country, there are economic conditions for the working class and the poor, even electricity. The fact that you can't have electricity throughout the country, any kind of national electrical grid. Isn't that a cause of this crisis? And also the corruption of this capitalist government is actually leading to a further crisis politically and anger among the people of Nigeria and workers of Nigeria.
You are correct. The crisis we have battled with for years in Nigeria, even by extension, majority of African countries, is capitalism, where ruling classes are living in the provocating style of life. They have availability of huge resources that they rob, they steal, and now the socio-economic crisis of poverty, of unemployment, of lack of education has assisted terrorist, banditry, whichever name you call it, to recruit people into their midst. The level of corruption in Nigeria has also opened the eyes of people to the resources available for people in power. So, corruption under capitalist system has directly influenced banditry and what Boko Haram, terrorism. And that is why some people have drawn the conclusion that crisis of capitalism has continued to conquer Nigeria for years, and it has exposed Nigerian people to an unending unemployment, poverty, lack of basic amenities, lack of, as I speak with you, from the city of power in Nigeria, we have not had electricity for 3 straight days. I'm charging presently in my car. I am not buoyant enough. I do not have money. I'm a working class activist and I'm a socialist. I don't have money to even provide an inverter of less than $500 for my family. So we have to struggle to get water, to get rest, because there is no electricity. I speak to you, two of my neighbors are running on generators, which you could hear the noise under. So those are that's the condition we live.
And Nigeria is one of the wealthiest countries in the world in oil, yet the government, the capitalist government, is incapable of having a national electrical grid for power for the people of Nigeria. And now, you said that you believe that the U.S. government, Trump, would like to have a base in Nigeria. You were saying earlier that you think one of the aims of Trump and the U.S. imperialism is to have a base in Nigeria?
Yes, most likely if this struggle continues. If they claim to come and fight to assist Nigeria to confront banditry, then there will be need to fight terrorism. There will be need for a military base.
And have the unions and workers made any statement about the U.S. bombing in Nigeria?
Yes. Our position has been that the working people can stamp out Boko Haram or any form of terrorism. But this cannot be done on the basis of capitalism. Capitalism breeds corruption, breeds poverty, breeds unemployment. So if the working class will fight banditry, it's going to be under a socialist radical government that is ready to confront the beast of corruption, which has escalated to the level where nothing is working in the country. We have always advocated for community defense. Many of these bandits also hide in communities. They hide on mountains. They live within the people. And the glaring fact is that some of the people are well known to people. We have had an experience in the past, and it was badly treated. They paid almost $5,000 to get the girl, $5,000 ransom to get the girl released. Now, it's evidence to all of us that many of the banditry are conniving with people also in power. So we have to confront them, we have to fight them, we have to make life unbearable for them until we were able to confront the ruling class who have also allowed this menace to continue.
Yeah, but the United States has trillions of dollars for war, for the war machine, for bombing, but it is incapable of not only helping the people of Nigeria, but also helping people in the United States who themselves face economic crisis, unemployment, healthcare. So it's an international problem.
Yes. The U.S. is a developed country with accumulated resources from other parts of the world and have huge money for defense because you have to go to support Israel, have to support Ukraine with NATO, have to go to fight in Caribbean Sea against Venezuela and so on and so forth. Now, Nigeria also have a huge defense. But the level of corruption in those who are ruling in the army generals are so high, we are not sure of what is possible. So, but it is glaring. Nothing is glaring.
Are you surprised about the connection between U.S. imperialism, both attacking Venezuela, which is a very wealthy country with oil, and Nigeria at the same time, the attack on both Venezuela and Nigeria, which are large countries with oil, which the United States wants and have said that it belongs to the United States?
We find that very funny because Nigeria also have huge resources, but the U.S. is fighting now in the northern part of Nigeria where there is no oil. So if they are fighting in the south, not in the south part of Nigeria, it's not sure. You know, the claim by the Trump that they have some oil seized in Venezuela was as a result of Hugo Chavez nationalizing some public some U.S. assets during the Bolivarian Revolution. And the crime the U.S. has committed against the U.S., against Venezuela for long, are signs that the U.S. only want to take the Venezuela oil. Like I said, the U.S. has been killing fishermen on the sea for years. And it is on our face, if they want to fight banditry, if they want to fight drug, it is for the U.S. to step up its security at the entrance of the U.S., not to lay siege on the Venezuela sea, where they were seizing vessels and everything. We must oppose this criminality. The Nigerian people, the solidarity we need now is to stop the U.S. invasion of Nigeria. Yes, we have the menace of banditry and terrorism. So what do we do from here? We need to fight back. How do we fight back? We need to build solidarity to reject all attempts to take over because we are not sure if the U.S. is actually interested in fighting terrorism in Nigeria. But we are sure of one thing. They may also be interested in Nigerian oil.
That was socialist Sadari Oladimeji from Nigeria, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
said 5 in the morning. I wake up to 5 for my earnings. Fear in my mind is a warning. Pray to the one you're relying. I've been wandering all day. I tried to be fine, but I can't be. The noise in my mind wouldn't leave me. I tried to get by, but I'm burning. Let me hide my mind.
That was Nigerian singer Tems, Free Mind. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. 8 Palestine solidarity activists are on a hunger strike in Britain over the continued support for the genocide by the British government. The Starmer Labour government has jailed thousands of opponents of genocide for simply having a sign supporting Palestine action. At a rally at the UK consulate in San Francisco on December 22nd, an Irish activist compared the UK's repression around Palestine to its repression in Ireland and talked about how it threatens the working class as a whole.
I bring solidarity from Irish in London for Palestine. Since this hunger strike began, we have had the honor of organizing with Prisoners for Palestine, the organization which is overseeing this hunger strike. In agitating for this demands of the 8 hunger strikers. The Irish community in the United Kingdom has unfortunately been the beneficiary of an enormous amount of unwanted attention from the British state around that very broad term, terrorism. Under the Prevention of Terrorism Acts, you saw a widespread crackdown and abuse by the British government of Irish people living within the United Kingdom. You had an enormous number of high-profile, wrongful convictions based on terrorism legislation of Irish people living in the UK during the Troubles. The Maguire family, the Birmingham Six, the Guildford Four, and many more. And that is why we, as Irish citizens and Irish people living in the United Kingdom, felt it was our right, our duty, to stand and talk about what the British government's usage of the Terrorism Act has done to communities before, and what it is doing now to Palestinian people, Palestinian supporters, many of whom, almost all of whom, are Arabs, South Asians, now communities under heavy, unneeded British government surveillance. So we have now the Terrorism Act of 2000, which is being used to crack down on Palestine activists. The Terrorism Act of 2000, when it was introduced, there was widespread discussion. You can look at this as a very good thread on the subject by Madhav Cairns of how this act would be used to potentially crack down on activists who damaged property. And it was explicitly stated by Jack Straw, the Home Secretary at the time, that the act would not be used against non-violent protesters who smashed up property, smashed up arms manufacturers, and yet now, 25 years later, we have seen that the discretion which the government depended upon that they wanted legislators to just trust them, that this very broad definition of terrorism would not be applied to those smashing up property. It has now been used, as of this August, to prescribe Palestine action. But even before this unjust prescription in August of this year, we saw the Terrorism Act being used to crack down on nonviolent Palestine protesters. In May of last year, three activists were arrested in London for holding a banner which had a white dove flying over the border wall, the supposed border wall in the West Bank. The justification given by the police was that the sky in the background of this image was blue, and there was a blue sky on October 7th, and therefore those arrested were showing support for Hamas. It's absolutely ridiculous. That case was later thrown out before it went to trial. But terrorism legislation has been used against members of Palestine Action who took action. We have, in particular, the Filton 24 activists who smashed into Elbit Systems site outside of Bristol, a site where killer quadcopters are built and other military hardware by this Israeli company, Elbit Systems. We have also the Bryce Norton five activists who broke onto a British military base and sprayed red paint on a British transport, two British transport aircraft. Those aircraft were later able to be perfectly serviceable, and yet it was more the image of activists on electric scooters driving onto a British Army base and spraying red paint that was so embarrassing for the British government that they pushed for the prescription of Palestine Action. And knowing that it would be a controversial prescription, they lumped it in with two other neo-fascist organizations, the Russian Imperial Movement and the Maniac Murder Cult, to add further justification to their unjust prescription of Palestine Action. Right now we have, and if you want to follow the trial of these six, I recommend looking at realmedia.press. We have the first six of the Filton 24 are standing trial. And what has come out in those trials has been again and again the disenchantment of the activists who are on trial with the democratic process. You are told, and we see it very often here in the United States, that if you want to make change, you protest, you write your elected representative, and they will put the people's will into action. And yet what we have seen again and again is that although the arming of Israel in the United Kingdom is widely reviled, although support for Israel is at historic lows, the supposed elected representatives in the United Kingdom do not display the people's will and instead back up the Israeli war machine to the nth degree, give it an enormous amount of leeway, an amount of carte blanche in the international arena, which they would afford to no other government, aside, that is, from the United States. And so those people who have taken action at Filton felt they had no other option but to place their bodies on the war machine, to do as Mario Savio in 1964, to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And that is what they did. They inflicted over $1.5 million worth of damage on Elbit Systems factory in Filton at that time. There was the initial six who were arrested, and then afterwards many more, and now we've got the Filton 24. Anyone who is related to that action has now been arrested and held under terrorism powers. And what that means is that they can be held incommunicado for up to a week with no legal support, and the government does not need to inform their loved ones where they are. They have many less legal rights. And so the prescription of Palestine Action, which followed the Bryce Norton action, was the first organization, nonviolent organization, to be prescribed as a terrorist group. There's a long history of nonviolent direct action in the United Kingdom, particularly of smashing up weapons systems, weapons factories. And none of those organizations have been prescribed as terrorist organizations before. In fact, in 2003, in the immediate run-up to the Iraq War, activists smashed up military transport planes, British military transport planes, and one of whom was defended in court by the current Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. Now, however, with the reins of power in his grasp, he has seen it necessary, in his view, in his disgusting, weak perspective as a leader who is bringing in, through his inept leadership of the United Kingdom, a right-wing, MAGA-like party under reform. And so we have the eight hunger strikers. As of yesterday, some of you may have seen, if you haven't seen otherwise, check Prisoners for Palestine for updates on the hunger strike. We have the eight hunger strikers. Amu is at an unknown location. The prisoners who have been detained under terrorism legislation are constantly being moved around. Their loved ones not informed of where they are. Amu, though we don't know where they are, we do know they are hospitalized. They're no longer being given updates on their electrolytes. Their wheelchair, which they needed, has been taken from them. And they could not get a GP appointment, be given medical care because of the inability to move. Kesser, who some of you may have seen, was successfully hospitalized after direct intervention by activists and the sitting MP Zara Sultana at the prison where she is being held, remains in hospital. Heba is not receiving medical care and recovering from what is suspected to have been COVID. Cameron is in hospital, yet we have happened in 3 days now where his family has not been given updates about his condition. Tueta has dangerously low blood sugar. Louis has been given no medical assistance and hasn't seen a doctor in 3 weeks. He is suffering from a severe case, which he's had for many years, of diabetes, and yet he's been denied medical care. And Umar, as you may have seen, has stopped his hunger strike at present. It is incumbent upon us, activists in the United Kingdom, but also activists around the world, to shame the British government for their abuse of terrorism legislation, for their treatment of hunger strikers. And so I'm thankful that all of you here have come in the rain to shame the British government at their consulate's office for their government's conduct in abusing and making a sham of the liberal democracy which they claim to uphold. So keep agitating for Palestine, keep agitating for the hunger strikers. One day in our lifetimes, Palestine will be free.
That was an Irish activist speaking at the UK consulate in San Francisco on December 22nd in defense of the 8 hunger strikers in Britain who are fighting the Starmer Labour Party's support for Gaza genocide.
There are currently 33 political prisoners for Palestine in UK jails, held without trial, accused of the complement of trying to stop the Gaza genocide with their bare hands. History will absolve you and condemn the courts. For our brothers and sisters behind the wall, for our sisters and brothers that gave their all. For our brothers and sisters behind the wall. For our sisters and brothers that gave their all. For our brothers and sisters behind the wall. For the aunties and uncles now facing court. For the mothers and fathers awaiting calls. You will liberate our soul, we will vindicate you all. Symbol of collective love, the depths of you a special precious metal that will never rust. You bled for us, shed for us, blood, tears, sweat for us, forever trust. You know the hidden truth of what the terror does is very strange. Many say you're freer than the rest of us. Forget the judge you saw above the court, he could never touch. And this is why you sit inside and killers riding limos, driving militarized lives. Got the nerve to say they're civilized, the fire in your eyes. The reason our spirits didn't die, the sinister crimes can't be legitimized by bitter lies. We kiss your hands, your love's a river to a distant land. No prison can hold you in history, your decision stands. Your key to the world with how deeply you felt. An energy and love they can't keep in a cell. There'll be space in the room when you're playing this tune, cause with your two hands you wrote your names on the moon. For our brothers and sisters behind the wall. For our sisters and brothers that gave their all. For our brothers and sisters behind the wall. For our sisters and brothers that gave their all. For our brothers and sisters behind the wall.
That was British rapper Low Key with a new song for Palestine. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Peter McCullough, who reports on U.S. biolabs conducting research on pathogens with potential biowarfare and pandemic implications. McCullough discusses gain-of-function laboratory methods that alter biological agents capable of triggering widespread outbreaks, alongside efforts to develop corresponding countermeasures. According to McCullough, these government-funded programs, often involving private companies and universities, operate at the crossroads of pandemic preparedness and biosecurity, where conflicting incentives may increase risk.
I'm going to give you a summary of U.S. biolabs working on pathogens of dual pandemic potential. This is a big deal, and I can tell you that our next big pandemic could occur from a lab right here in the United States. Despite the new Trump administration coming into power, they have done little or nothing to protect Americans against these threats. Now, dual pandemic potential refers to biological agents and research programs that involve pathogens capable of causing a pandemic and preventing one, depending on how the knowledge or technology is used. These programs sit at the intersection of pandemic preparedness and biosecurity risk. The same research that can produce vaccines or antiviral measures can also inadvertently or deliberately create more virulent or transmissible versions of existing pathogens. In the United States, such work falls under a web of research categories called gain-of-function research, pathogen enhancement research of concern, PERC, and dual use research of concern, DURC, D-U-R-C, all of which have drawn heavy scrutiny due to their possible overlap with bioweapons capabilities. Here's some information about the structure of U.S. biodefense and pathogen research. These are the major institutions that are involved. The U.S. biodefense network spans dozens of federal, military, and laboratory and private laboratories. The most relevant players include the National Institutes of Health, particularly the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, previously run by Anthony Fauci. This body funds major dual-use pathogen research under the banner of pandemic preparedness. The U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRIID, located at Fort Detrick, Maryland, responsible for high-level containment, biosecurity level 4 experiments on Ebola, Marburg, anthrax, and other potential bioweapon-class pathogens. The Department of Homeland Security operates biolabs such as the National Bio and Agro-Defense Facility, NBAF, in Kansas, replacing the Plum Island Animal Disease Center. These labs handle zoonotic pathogens, animal-to-human transmission, like common origin for pandemics. And then the Centers for Disease Control operates BSL-4 labs in Atlanta that handle smallpox and highly infectious viruses. Private contractors and universities, including EcoHealth Alliance, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Boston University, University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, numerous pharmaceutical partners. These institutions often carry out federally funded research, but with far less transparency than governmental labs. So here are the categories of dual pathogen research. So gain-of-function studies. Gain-of-function research involves modifying pathogens to increase transmissibility, virulence, or host range to study how pandemics might evolve naturally. Critics argue that such experiments create the very conditions for accidental pandemics. Example, modifying the avian influenza, H5N1, to become an airborne transmissible in humans. That was done at the USDA Research Center in Athens, Georgia. And to be clear, this is transmissible among male or ducks and then onto mammals. Another example is engineering coronaviruses with modified spike proteins to increase infectivity, done in Wuhan, China. Supporters claim these methods allow creation of preemptive vaccines. Detractors note that a single lab breach could unleash a pathogen far more dangerous than nature would ever produce. And that's exactly what happened with both bird flu and with COVID-19. Now, there's reverse vaccinology and synthetic pathogens. Advances in genetic engineering now allow scientists to create synthetic viruses, reconstructing extinct strains like smallpox relatives or designing completely new ones to test vaccine platforms. COVID-19 accelerated this field as messenger RNA technology allowed rapid prototyping, but it also demonstrated how dual-use gene synthesis could be leveraged for malicious or unsafe gain-of-function work under the private or academic cover. Now, the biodefense simulations and challenge studies, human challenge trials where healthy volunteers are exposed to pathogens, often blur ethical boundaries, especially when strains are enhanced. A lesson from past biodefense simulations, such as the 2001 Dark Winter Anthrax exercise, is that preparedness often doubles as live lab work in the creation, testing, and containment of potential pandemic agents, meaning we never really know if a pathogen is capable of creating a pandemic until it gets out of the lab. Now, there's some major research examples of dual pandemic potential. So clearly, coronaviruses. Between 2014 and 2019, U.S.-funded researchers conducted experiments combining bat coronaviruses with humanized cell receptors. The stated goal, explore pandemic potential and test vaccine design. This research was controversial, not only because of its biosafety mismatches, some done in BSL-2 or BSL-3 conditions, where containment was insufficient, but also it went on during a federal moratorium on gain-of-function research. The problem wasn't simply location. Several projects conducted through nonprofit intermediaries outsourced parts of research to foreign labs, notably Wuhan Institute of Virology under the EcoHealth Alliance, underlining both globalization of biotech and weak oversight that could have been a national security risk. The other labs involved in the creation of the COVID-19 virus include University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, Dr. Ralph Barrick, and the Rocky Mountain NIH Research Laboratory in Hamilton, Montana, under the direction of Anthony Fauci and his division. Another major example is Boston University's hybrid SARS-CoV-2 experiment in 2022. Researchers combined ancestral Omicron strains to create a chimeric virus, resulting in 80% lethality in infected rodents. NIH later stated it hadn't authorized such work. The university insisted it was routine, illustrating ongoing lack of clarity between definitions of gain of function and then P3CO, which is potential pandemic pathogen care and oversight, and other bureaucratic categories. And lastly, there's unreported BSL 3 and 4 lab incidents. A Freedom of Information Act request revealed over 200 documented lab accidents involving infectious materials across federally funded institutions 2004 to 2019, vast majority underreported or sanitized in official summaries, reflecting the chronic transparency deficit in biosecurity research. And just to give you an idea, the Pandora report, which came out recently on December 15th, 2025, by Kellogg and colleagues, highlighted basically a biosecurity breach at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. And this was really a complete disaster. And so this happened through 2024, reported in 2025. Now, there are economic institutional motives. The structure of dual-use research incentives is problematic. The funding dependency, the labs compete for NIH and DOD grants. The pandemic potential becomes an attractive pitch. Big pharma partnerships, companies gain early access to experimental strains that later justify vaccine development contracts. Regulatory capture, the committees overseeing biosafety are often staffed by representatives of the very institutions that regulate, a revolving door that mirrors the pharmaceutical and defense industries. Patent economics, engineering new strains creates new intellectual property for vaccine platforms, incentivizing a cycle of problem creation, solution, sale. By their nature, these dynamics mean that dual-use research cannot be properly disentangled from profit interests. The public faces the risk. Private actors secure the patents and payouts. Now, what are the oversights and mechanisms here and their weaknesses? This P3CO framework established in 2017 to regulate enhanced potential pandemic pathogens, EPPP, however, the implementation remains murky. There's no public database of approved proposals. Decisions are made behind closed doors. Exemptions easily granted under biodefense or vaccine testing justifications. There's a select agent program. This program nominally monitors possession of regulatory pathogens like anthrax or Ebola. However, enforcement relies on self-reporting and rarely imposes penalty for lab breaches. And number three, Freedom of Information Act evasion. Many projects are classified under national security exemptions, even when conducted by universities. This shields funding sources, biosafety incident reports, and publication data. So the global ramifications are that dual-use pathogen research isn't just a U.S. issue, but because of U.S. dominance in biotech funding and globalization of research partners, U.S. oversight or lack thereof directly shapes the world's biosafety environment. Outsourcing to partner nations amplifies risks through jurisdictional escape. Research that would be illegal in the United States is quietly executed abroad, like in China with creation of SARS-CoV-2. The cycle of create, contain, cure entrenches a dependency on central vaccine production and surveillance systems, further consolidating institutional power over global health. Let me tell you, the next vaccine will probably be a government-issued vaccine with rich profits to the manufacturer. This model effectively transforms pandemics into recurrent business opportunities with vaccines and diagnostics as profitable endpoints, not as preventive measures. There are ethical and strategic implications. The moral dilemma emerges here. How do we justify research that could save lives if its mere existence could end billions? The argument for preemptive study relies on a utilitarian logic that collapses under real-world incentive structures. No laboratory is 100% secure. Even the BSL-4 facilities experienced leaks, smallpox escape in the UK 1978, or anthrax mishandling at the CDC Center in 2014. Those are just examples. The University of Texas Medical Branch lab leak recently. The energy devoted to hypothetical vaccine prototypes diverts funding from low-risk, high-yield measures like sanitation, air quality improvement, nutritional interventions, and early treatment protocols. Centralizing pandemic science under secrecy perpetuates an arms race of viral enhancement, reminiscent of nuclear proliferation cloaked as biodefense. So in conclusion, rethinking this pandemic preparedness, the U.S. approach to dual pandemic potential pathogens is a paradox wrapped in bureaucracy. On paper, it serves health security. In reality, it creates an ongoing feedback loop. To number one, engineer dangerous pathogens. Number two, model crisis and procure funding. Number three, develop vaccine or for the pathogen that's created. Number four, repeat increasingly under secrecy. This perpetual self-licking ice cream cone of biosurveillance and vaccine development endangers the public under the guise of protecting it. It amplifies why transparency, not secrecy, is a first principle of biosecurity. Until an independent oversight system is in place, this is really beyond self-policing federal committees. The U.S. biosafety landscape will continue to operate as a gray zone of moral hazard, blending scientific ambition, economic incentive, and military influence into one volatile mixture. So in summary, U.S. biolabs working on pathogens of dual pandemic potential embody a dangerously blurred line between health defense and biohazardous offense. While their stated mission is to prevent the next global outbreak, the secrecy, funding incentives, and deficiencies in oversight mean that much more of the research itself may constitute the next outbreak's root cause. The convergence of biotechnology, military defense interests, and pharmaceutical profits have produced an ecosystem where pandemic prevention laboratories, ironically, represent humanity's most consistent pandemic risk, meaning the next pandemic almost certainly is going to come out of a biosecurity lab and not come out of nature.
That was Dr. Peter McCullough reporting on U.S. biolabs and their secret, untransparent research on potential pandemic organisms with biowarfare potential. This McCullough Report excerpt aired originally on December 28, 2025 on America Out Loud. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.